Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Republicans take on Obamacare, Senate hearings on Russian hacking, a Facebook Live beating. President Obama and Vice President-elect Mike Pence both headed to Capitol Hill to rally their parties on the Affordable Care Act. Here was Pence.
The first order of business is to keep our promise to repeal Obamacare.
At Senate hearings on the Russian hacking of the U.S. election season yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham had a message for President-elect Donald Trump and praise for U.S. intelligence services.
Putin's up to no good, and he better be stopped. And Mr. President-elect, when you listen to these people, you can be skeptical, but understand they're the best among us, and they're trying to protect us.
And out of Chicago, a hideous live stream video of four black teens beating a disabled white man. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson spoke after hate crime charges had been quickly brought.
Let me be very clear. The actions in that video are reprehensible. That, along with racism, have absolutely no place in the city of Chicago.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes, Tom Bullock, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Who do you believe on Russian hacking? Who do you trust on Obamacare? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are broadcasting today from Charlotte, North Carolina, in the studios of Charlotte Public Radio Station WFAE. We're in Charlotte as part of On Point's national listening tour after the 2016 election, and want to thank all the WFAE listeners we met last night and WFAE for its hospitality. Joining me now from Washington for our news roundtable is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy Cordes, great to have you. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
With us in Charlotte today is Tom Bullock, political and investigative reporter for WFAE. Tom, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And from our studio in Boston, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Tom.
Can we go straight to the hearings of the intelligence chiefs before the Senate in Washington yesterday? Here was Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. He was asked if he and his colleagues stood by their earlier statements claiming that Russian hacking had been in the middle of the U.S. election season.
We stand actually more resolutely on the strength of that statement that we made on the 7th of October.
And here's Senator John McCain, Republican, at those hearings.
Every American should be alarmed by Russia's attacks on our nation. There is no national security interest more vital to the United States of America than the ability to hold free and fair elections without foreign interference.
Nancy Cordes in Washington, paint the picture for us of these hearings yesterday, even in a week where Donald Trump continued to put out tweets casting doubt on the allegation that Russians were all over the U.S. election campaign.
And that doubt really hung over the entire hearing, Tom. You could tell from the way that lawmakers crafted their questions, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, that what they were trying to get at was that they, A, believe the intelligence when Donald Trump has cast a lot of doubt, and B, particularly when it comes to the Democrats, that it may actually be doing damage to the morale and reputation of the agents who sometimes put their lives at risk to gather this information. And when pressed, he didn't volunteer it, but when pressed, Clapper said that, yes, he is concerned about morale. He is fielding questions from his counterparts around the world who wonder why the president-elect is openly questioning information that he's getting from his intelligence officials. And beyond that, what is particularly troubling to a lot of lawmakers is that Mr. Trump would openly appear to be siding with Julian Assange, who claims that he did not get this hacked material from Russian state actors over over what he's getting from U.S. intelligence officials. Intelligence officials see Assange as something of a public enemy number one. A lot of lawmakers agree with them. And even though Trump has now pulled back a little bit and says, well, no, I don't necessarily agree with Assange. I just think it's important to get his views out there. It is deeply troubling to members on both sides.
Nancy, the president-elect scheduled, as we speak right now, to sit down today with the chiefs of American intelligence. Was there fresh evidence yesterday or this week to further buttress their assertion that Russia and Russian hacking played a role on behalf of Donald Trump in the campaign season, Nancy?
Clapper said that he is even more convinced now than he was back when he first put out this statement in October that Russia was behind these attacks, not just hacking, but also misinformation, fake news, propaganda, and the like. He says that his report will detail multiple motives for the hacking. And this is a report that was given to President Obama on Thursday. It will be laid out for President-elect Trump today, as you point out. And then the public will be able to see a lot of it early next week. And while Clapper said that there are some details that need to be classified because they're sensitive, sources and methods and that kind of thing, he said he is pushing the envelope, in his words. He's trying to get as much detail out there as possible because he believes that Americans deserve the full picture of what happened.
Tom Bullock with me here in Charlotte, North Carolina. We've got tweets pouring out from the president. I mean, in a given week, I've got a big stack of them here. And he has paid attention to this issue. And even in the middle of this week, still casting doubt on these assertions. How do you think all this is going down? I mean, Americans paying attention to what's going on Capitol Hill. Senators hearing directly from all these intelligence chiefs. The president-elect still casting doubt. Where do you feel the sort of meter of public confidence in terms of whether the Russians actually got in here and messed with the election, Tom?
Well, it's fascinating to watch because you're seeing the showdown between Republicans on Capitol Hill, as Nancy was describing. And as she said, this was a hearing that was really an audience of one, really kind of seemed aimed at President-elect Trump. The only real line that you had, at least from representatives that were challenging what the intelligence community was saying, was Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. And he just took umbrage with the way that they said hacking the election, and he wanted to stress that it didn't change the result. But I think on the ground, Tom, what it real boils down to is it matters on who you supported in the first place. I don't think this is changing Trump's supporters' views. I think that Trump has come out pretty clearly and said, you know, he's disparaged the intelligence community. He continues to use quotations around the word intelligence in those tweets, which I think is very telling, even when he's saying he's a big fan, that those quotations are still there.
And as if they're not intelligent.
Exactly. And, you know, I think what you're really seeing is, you know, the siloed American political spectrum that we have right now, where you're a Trump supporter, you're a Clinton supporter, you're a Republican or a Democrat, it's probably not going to move the meter individually that much. But for Republicans on Capitol Hill, this was their first time where they seemed to split with President-elect Trump on policy, specifically when it comes to this hack.
And, of course, we had the Director of National Intelligence himself, James Clapper, responding to a question about President-elect Trump's mocking of the intelligence community.
There is an important distinction here between healthy skepticism, which policymakers, to include policymaker number one, should always have for intelligence. But I think there's a difference between skepticism and disparagement.
Jack Beatty, the president-elect, supposed to sit down with these chiefs today. How does an executive branch deal with this kind of relationship between the White House and the heads of intelligence? And how does this country deal with the standing assertion here that, no, not in the count of the election, but yes, very much in the heat of the election campaign, Russian hacking was right in there and in there with a purpose, Jack?
Well, Tom, on the first front, if after today's briefing, Mr. Trump persists in denial or offers more of his implausible alternatives. They've included the Chinese, a 400-pound man, a teenage boy. If he continues on that tack, he'll signal a really dangerous divorce from security realities, an acute inability to accept information that challenges his view of the world. You know, that's at one level willful ignorance. At another level, it's motivated ignorance. And if motivated by what? By wounded narcissism? Well, for Mr. Trump, that's a sort of ready explanation for anything. I mean, it's understandable that he would feel that this has been used or could be used, these charges, to cast an illegitimate cloud over his election. Or if not wounded narcissism, could there be actual Russian influence on his thinking? We just don't know. And as to the larger consequences, what happens in a crisis? Does the president-elect, take what the intelligence services are telling him with proper skepticism as a kind of rough mirror to reality? Or does he act on his own posits, on his own a priori view of the world, on his own gut? And if so, with what results for the country?
Nancy Cordes, where does the whole country go forward on this front? I mean, it's been difficult enough for the Obama administration to figure out exactly what to do in response. You had Lindsey Graham, Republican, saying yesterday he's ready to throw a rock, as in this requires a response. But if you have a president who's talking about warmer relations with Moscow on the one hand, and on the other hand you have heads of intelligence saying they just interfered with our most sacred exercise of democracy, where do we go on the action path next here, Nancy, under soon-to-be President Trump?
Right. Well, the question is, even if lawmakers could convince Donald Trump that Russia was behind the hacking and merited a retaliation, the question is, what kind of rock do you throw? And interestingly, throughout that three-hour hearing, we heard almost no detail from lawmakers, from intelligence officials, about the options that are available to the U.S. government. And from talking to intelligence officials afterwards and lawmakers, it's pretty clear that they don't really have many great options. In the hearing, Director Clapper said that cyber retaliation is really not the way to go, that has been considered and essentially discarded because it requires you to use the infrastructure of another country, in this case Russia, and that runs afoul of some international laws. So beyond that, you've got sanctions. We already impose a lot of sanctions on Russia. You could step that up, but nobody seemed to have any other ideas about things the U.S. could be doing that we're not doing now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're broadcasting today from Charlotte, North Carolina, and we're looking at a week in the news. We're in the studios of WFAE. Tom Bullock, political investigative reporporter from WFAE, is with us today. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News, one of the best out there, is with us from Washington. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, is with us from Boston today. You can join us in this conversation. We're looking at Russian hacking, the intelligence chiefs, the hearings there, Republicans on Obamacare, who will pay for a border wall, that ugly beating in Chicago goes viral, Facebook Live, wow, live streamed. You can join us today. What do you think about the hearings on U.S. intelligence and Russian hacking? What do you think about all the talk this week in Washington on Obamacare, and what should, what will, what might happen there? Let's go to our listeners, John in Richmond, Vermont. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you. I want to echo what Jack said earlier in terms of Mr. Trump's apparent disregard for the intelligence community. I think there are real-world consequences to whatever he does or says. And the fact that our allies and, more importantly, someone like Vladimir Putin knows that he may not be listening to his own advisors, that scares me to death. And I'm very concerned about this display of hubris on Mr. Trump's part. And, the domestic agenda seems to be, there are more checks and balances. He's got, challenges within his own party in both the House and Senate. But on an international basis, wow, I'm very concerned.
Yeah, the world watching here. Let me get one more. John, I appreciate your call. Reed in Asheville, North Carolina. Reed, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm a little bit different than the previous caller. I still have some skepticism over whether or not Russia was actually behind it, but I'm coming more from Glenn Greenwald and The Intercept's point of view in Show Us the Evidence. The intelligence community is the same community that told us there were WMDs in Iraq and told us they weren't keeping track of emails phone records and text records of U.S. citizens. So I just want the evidence. I think we need to do what's correct, but I'm still skeptical. Thank you so much.
Rita, I appreciate your call as well. Nancy Cordes, there at CBS News, we are supposed to hear more. I mean, there are full reports here, and different parties are seeing different portions of those reports. Presumably, President Obama and President-elect Trump will see all of them. Something will be put out to the public next week. How much more detail is the public likely to learn to see about the evidence behind these allegations, Nancy?
Well, that's a great question, and I think you can see from that last call from Reid why Clapper is so eager to get as much information out there as possible. He understands that this skepticism of institutions more broadly and the intelligence community in particular exists. He understands that some of that has been fueled by Donald Trump. Some of it has been fueled by past intelligence failures like the weapons of mass destruction, which he said yesterday the intelligence community isn't perfect, but has learned a lot and learned a lot from that mistake. I would guess that, you know, he is well aware and other intelligence officials are well aware that their conclusions are on the line here when it comes to public perception, and that the more that they can put out there without jeopardizing the ways that they got this information in the first place will certainly help the case that they are trying to make. If you think about it, this is pretty extraordinary. You don't typically see reports from the intelligence community being put out there in the public domain, and you don't usually see public officials demanding that they see how exactly intelligence officials came to their conclusions before they accept what the intelligence community is saying.
Tom Bullock, of course, this is an extraordinary situation. U.S. intelligence has been wrong before. Mm-hmm. Yes, we've seen that. On the other hand, if a big foreign power can come in every 2 or 4 years and diddle around with the U.S. election process just enough to tilt it the way that it likes, the very integrity of our democracy is on the line. This is a big deal. It's hard to just take that lying down.
Oh, absolutely. And it's just the perception that our democracy could be muddled with that could cause more doubt to be sown when it comes to our politicians. But I want to go to one other thing that Reid said, which I think is a fascinating parallel between weapons of mass destruction and the failed and flawed intelligence there, mm-hmm. and what we're seeing right here. And if you go back and look at the autopsies of the intelligence reports that led us into the war in Iraq, what we found is that the intelligence was cherry-picked and guided to fit a certain preconceived notion by the Bush administration.
Which in that case came from the top, came from the White House.
That's correct. What you're seeing now here, I think, is a dangerous path that Trump could be taking to repeat the same mistakes. If he does not stop to listen to the intelligence community, he and instead cherry-picks information, whether it be from Julian Assange or anything else, he could be walking that same path. And that is exactly the criticism of the intelligence community that both Reid and Donald Trump like to point out.
Jack, that's a good point. I mean, you go back to the WMD and the intelligence community ended up saying, look, if there's a mea culpa here, it's kind of that we folded to the agenda of the White House.
Yes, and Trump is putting our intelligence services under unprecedented pressure to do just that. And, you know, you couple that with a rule that's just been passed by the House Republicans. It hasn't been enacted yet, but apparently it's been passed. And this rule would allow essentially the Congress to zero out the salary of federal officials, of even civil service officials. And you know, people are worried that this will mean people in the Energy Department who've attended seminars on global warming. The Trump has been interested in finding out their names. People in the State Department are worried that it will affect people that have dealt with gender equality internationally. That's something the Trump people have inquired about. But it could also deal with intelligence officials who don't tell Trump what he wants to hear.
One more call, and I want to turn to Obamacare. Linda in Charlotte, North Carolina. Linda, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I just don't think that I'd buy totally into what the intelligence community have to say, because with something this important as an election, I would imagine they would have been monitoring it right from the beginning, and they really only came up with the fact that it was Russian hacking after the fact. And there was a time where Obama went on record, and there's proof, I've heard the recording, that he says that Mr. Trump needs to get over the fact there never was Russian hacking and there never will be. So I don't buy into the Russian hacking thing. I think it is something that has been driven by the Democratic Party and the president.
Linda, I think you're quite wrong on Obama having said that. I do not think the president said what you just asserted there. But, I mean, Tom, you can see, and I take your point, though, why not earlier? And there were criticisms yesterday, Lindsey Graham and others, why not earlier?
Sure.
On the other hand, if the Democratic sitting president had earlier said this is going on, people would have said, well, you're trying to throw the election.
Yeah, and one thing I want to say to the caller's point is, to be clear, these allegations are not about hacking the actual results. Mm-hmm. It's about disseminating false news stories. It's about the WikiLeaks email releases. So it's a little bit different. It was trying to mold public perception as opposed to alter vote counts. But, you know, we don't see a whole lot of these things because it's supposed to. These are clandestine operations. But we do have President Obama on record saying that he told Russian President Vladimir Putin in October to knock it off.
Knock it off.
And that was supposedly in October. Now, we cannot obviously independently verify that, but that is what the president has said he did.
It's a whole world still to come on this front. We'll see how this plays out over time. You got Republicans themselves divided as Donald Trump moves in. And, of course, we'll see if his view of this evolves after the scheduled meeting today with all these intelligence chiefs. I want to turn to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Job one, Vice President-elect Mike Pence said, of course, he was on Capitol Hill, so was the president, to rally forces here. Pence said the Trump administration's efforts to repeal Obamacare would begin on day one.
We're going to keep our promise to the American people, and we're going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with solutions that lower the cost of health insurance without growing the size of government.
Democrats said they don't know what they're doing. They don't know where they're headed. Here's Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat, Kentucky, talked with MSNBC about the effort by Republicans to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
The fact of the matter is that if Republicans do what they want to do, which is to repeal this law without replacing it, without offering anything in its stead, there will be chaos for everyone in the healthcare system, not just people who are on these exchanges.
Chris Murphy of Connecticut, of course. And here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer had this to say about the Republican effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
The Republican plan to cut health care wouldn't make America great again. It would make America sick again.
Playing with a big Trump line there. Nancy Cordes, you're there on Capitol Hill. What do you see having played out in this first week? I mean, it was an odd week. The first effort by the Republicans as they came into power was to try to gut this ethics oversight operation there. They later pulled back on that after a lot of pushback. But next up was Obamacare. And where do we stand in the repeal-replace continuum, Nancy?
Well, the first vote has taken place. This is a vote on legislation that would speed up the dismantling of Obamacare so that they could begin to repeal large chunks of the law within the next 30 to 45 days. You did not see this week any details about either the short term, what would take place immediately after the law was repealed, and it seems pretty clear at this point. There are really no obstacles for Republicans repealing it. Democrats simply don't have the votes. So what happens next? Republicans say there will be a transition period, but they haven't said what that transition period will be like, what will happen to people who currently get their insurance through Obamacare, and then what's the long-term plan? They were not able to provide any specifics on that either. And that left a big opening for Democrats to say, look, you're so zealous about repealing this law, but you have absolutely no idea what you're going to replace it with. And so what you saw was kind of an escalating PR war about who's going to end up holding the bag the day after repeal if people start to lose their insurance. Republicans saying, look, this law was falling apart anyway. People were already losing their insurance options. And Democrats saying, well, that's because you didn't lift a finger in the past half decade to help us fix the parts of the law that needed improving.
Nancy, that means it's a gamble for Republicans who have the power now. It's in their power to act and the way that they act. What about divisions between Republicans themselves? Is there a majority of Republicans who are ready to repeal without a replacement fully understood?
Most Republicans are ready to repeal because this is a promise that they have been making to their constituents for years. And this has been their greatest wish, is to repeal this law. And so there are some Republicans who feel a little uneasy about the notion of repealing without having something in the wings to replace it with. But that view is clearly overshadowed by the majority, who say, you know, we've been promising we're going to rip this law out by its roots, and we're prepared to do it.
Tom Bullock, how do you see the risk Republicans are facing here? If they go ahead with that repeal, they don't have a full plan, and some say not even a full conception of how to raise a plan that would replace it. What's the political risk that they, and for that matter, Americans who need health insurance, face?
Well, the political risk can actually be seen by a report that was issued today that shows the top five states for Obamacare recipients. And let's just talk on the presidential level. Mm-hmm. They are Florida, Texas, North Carolina, Georgia, and Pennsylvania.
Oh, boy. Big, big swinging voting chunks there.
Pretty important states, like battleground states, and Texas, of course, is a big key state for Republicans to hold. Mm-hmm. But it's politically, this could end up all at their feet. Politically, this could be their chance to finally do what they wanted to do and then fail at it. And this tactic that Nancy's talking about now, which is, seems to be, you know, repeal and delay as opposed to repeal and replace, has problems because in a business sense, if you think about what business hates more than anything, mm-hmm. it's uncertainty. And with this uncertainty, what are health insurers bound to do? And we don't know the answer to that, because despite just the Senate vote that has already happened, we're still waiting to hear what executive actions President-elect Donald Trump will take, as he says, on day one.
Because a lot of this was implemented via executive action,
tweaks,
because Congress, the tweaks, because Congress would not come in and do it themselves.
Yeah, and just to give you an idea, you know, this is not just something that the media is saying. Here's a mm-hmm. concrete example of an executive action Trump could take immediately, mm-hmm. which would, you know, in essence, stop Obamacare in its tracks. He has the ability through executive action to get rid of the subsidy
yeah.
that everybody pays. I mean,
yeah.
this is what makes it affordable to a lot of people.
Take that away and boom, it's essentially gone for many, many.
And now take this from the insurance company's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
The subsidy's gone, but they're still stuck accepting those policies at the same price. So they're not getting the money, because you could also take away the money that they give
yeah.
to the insurance
yeah.
companies. So if you're an insurance company and if you're worried about the bottom line,
get
this
out
uncertainty
of town.
Is going to cause a major chaos.
Brad in Charlotte, North Carolina, where we're broadcasting from today. Brad, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. I was just listening to what your speaker was saying there about the, you know, the insurance not being able to afford the Affordable Care Act. I am a proponent of government health care, Obamacare, as it's called. I've heard both good and bad about it, people that have benefited, others who haven't. I personally am uninsured. I have family in Canada, and, you know, we all know that they have, like, a socialist health care system. And I hope that the new president will do good on his word, where he said they would not only repeal but replace with something better. And why not just add, you know, I think many Americans be willing to pay a little bit higher tax and have their health care taken care of. It's just, we haven't given it a shot yet, I don't think.
Are you ready for Canadian style universal coverage? Is that what you're getting at, Brad?
Yes, I am socialist in that view. I think that we can afford, and it's worth affording, health care. It's the most important part of our lives. Everyone at some point is going to need health care. We have to make ourselves afford it. I mean, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Canada as a whole country. As I said, my aunt had leukemia. Her health bill was $0. They didn't have to stress about, how am I going to pay? Am I going to lose my home? You know, are my children going to be on the street?
And you listen to a story like that, and you pretty much know they're not in the USA. Jack Beatty, I mean, here we get to the nub of it. Donald Trump was very straightforward. Said, we're going to replace it with something better. And here's a voter who has supported Obamacare but would like something better. He's counting on Trump to deliver that. But it's Republicans on Capitol Hill who are going to have to stand up and structure something, Jack.
Yes, and if they follow the policy of repeal and delay, well, the American College of Physicians warned that just simply uncertainty this year, and Brad raised that, could cost something like 7 million Americans their health insurance. You know, there's a moral dimension to this. These big programs are reworked. Social Security was passed in 1935, and in 1939 it had to be opened up all over again and all kinds of problems dealt with. forth. Medicare has been revised again and again. It is part of social innovation that you have to keep changing policy in the light of emerging realities. Obamacare and its problems are fixable. What isn't fixable is the human cost here. You know, on the eve of Obamacare, one study found that lack of health insurance was killing one American every 24 minutes. That's the moral weight here. They've got to put in something to replace it and to replace it adequately.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, after a season of tough standoffs with Donald Trump and allegations of sexual harassment against former Fox News chief Roger Ailes, Megyn Kelly announced she is leaving Fox for NBC News.
So I'll be leaving Fox News at the week's end and starting a new adventure, joining the journalists at NBC News, who I deeply admire.
Okay, new way. A bloody New Year's Eve terror attack on an Istanbul nightclub left 39 dead in Turkey. Francois Alasmar survived the shooting, though he was shot through the shoulder.
He fired one shot on its own, so I thought he could have been drunk. But a few seconds later, we heard a machine gun. When I was shot, I lay down. I acted dead, so he didn't continue to shoot me.
And a memorable malfunction at Mariah Carey's New Year's Eve performance in Times Square. The lip-syncing track didn't work, and the star turned her mic to the audience.
This is the album version, so I'm just going to let you put this skirt on me and sing along with it. Or not sing, but just have a moment.
Oh boy, what a mess on New Year's Eve. We are looking at a week in the news. Trump and U.S. intelligence chiefs on Russian hacking, Republicans on Obamacare, who will pay for a border wall, and an ugly beating in Chicago goes viral. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Tom Bullock is here, political reporter for WFAE in Charlotte, where we're broadcasting today. Jack Beatty's here, On Point News analyst, and you can join us as well. Are you surprised that U.S. taxpayers will be asked to pay up front for that border wall? What do you see in the terrible beating video out of Chicago? What do you make of Dylan Roof expressing no remorse in Charleston? And what do you think of Texas now introducing its own bathroom bill for your gender at birth only? Lots of talk on the campaign trail from Donald Trump about how Mexico would pay for the wall. A little more complicated than that, maybe. In an interview with CNN, New York Republican Representative Chris Collins said that U.S. taxpayers would have to foot the bill for the wall in the short term, but that Trump will be able to negotiate reimbursement from Mexico.
I would not tell you right now that Donald Trump won't sit down with Mexico and have them reimburse the taxpayers. But of course, we have to pay the bills. We're building the wall.
Wait a minute. Of course, we have to pay the bills. Nancy Cordes, what happened to that nice, simple campaign trail language? We're going to build a wall and Mexico will pay for it, period.
Well, now Mr. Trump is tweeting that obviously the taxpayers will pay first, but then they will somehow be reimbursed by the Mexican government. It's hard to see how the Mexicans, who have always made it clear they have no intention in paying for the wall up front, would somehow be willing to pay on the back end, even though they really don't get anything out of having a wall there. They don't want a wall. It's designed to keep their citizens out of the U.S. It doesn't really do much to protect them in their view. So, you know, that's one of this week's more genuine head scratchers.
Is there a mechanism out there that you can imagine that would, in effect, compel Mexico to pay, force them in some roundabout way, a tariff or withholding of monies transferred back to Mexico or some other leverage by which the Trump administration could, in effect, force Mexican payment?
Not that I've heard of so far. It's possible that they could try to devise something. I think what's really interesting here is how quickly some Republicans want to move to enable Donald Trump to keep part of one of his biggest campaign promises, which was to build this wall, if not to build it with Mexican cash, at least to build it, period. And they're looking at a number of different legislative options so that they could do it even within the next few months to pass legislation that would enable them to start construction. One big hang-up, however, is the bill and the fact that there are some Republicans who are going to balk if the cost runs into the billions at the priorities here, because they believe that the deficit is too big, that the debt is too big, and that the U.S. has to be more careful about what it spends on and what it doesn't.
Tom Bullock, the headlines all over the place now saying, well, is Mexico really going to pay for the wall? Do voters care if the wall goes up? Do you think voters are going to care who pays for it in the end, Tom? It was a pretty clear promise from Mr. Trump, but what about accountability there?
Well, this is where do we take him literally or do we take him seriously really comes back into play. And he did here in North Carolina lay out a specific way. He said he would get Mexico to pay for that wall. Uh-huh. And he said it would be through tariffs and that what he would do is threaten tariffs and then Mexico would agree to pay for the wall and then they would build it. So for a guy who likes to pride himself on being a great negotiator, if we're building it at taxpayer expense, I think your negotiation stance has gotten a little weak there. So when it comes to Trump supporters, though, we've seen changes before. I don't think one individual flop or flip, however you want to call it, from Trump would necessarily change a Trump supporter's mind. But when you take them in aggregate, when you think about the fact there will be no special prosecutor, he said, for Hillary Clinton, that now taxpayers are going to pay for the wall. And there's a lot of fiscal conservatives are going to take umbrage with that. Mm-hmm. When you take all of these kind of changes, the question is, in aggregate, is that going to get his base supporter to start losing faith in their president-elect?
Jack, how do you look at the wall issue, the credibility issue, as Donald Trump heads for Inauguration Day?
Well, it's acute, and as Tom suggests, it's manifold. This is emblematic of a series of retreats. I mean, drain the swamp. We seem to have mm-hmm. peopled the swamp with more alligators. And on this business of the wall, you know, a few years ago, a Princeton political scientist found that the hardening of the border that had already gone on, absent the wall, was preventing Mexican immigrants in our country from returning to Mexico illegally. In other words, they wanted to leave, but they couldn't. They couldn't cross the border. It was just too dangerous. So that the hardening we had taken had been counterproductive. And we had a whole program, Tom, last year, with experts saying that this business of hordes of people coming over the border, that's yesterday's problem, and that this border wall would be a kind of Maginot line dealing with a vanished or a relatively a limited problem.
I want to bring it right closer to home in this Facebook live stream out of Chicago, so disturbing this week, of four teenagers spending hours apparently beating a disabled young man, 18-year-old, in Chicago. Teenagers, African-Americans, white disabled guy, which gave it a strong racial kind of electricity here. It was very difficult to watch. Here was the grandmother of the Facebook Live beating victim talking with NBC affiliate Chicago 5 News yesterday.
I will not look at the video. I don't want to see it. I don't want to watch him suffering. I know he did.
And here was President Obama in an interview with Chicago CBS affiliate WBBM. President Obama is talking about racial tensions.
What we've seen is surfacing, I think, a lot of the problems that have been there a long time, whether it's tensions between police and communities, whether it's hate crimes of the despicable sort that has just now recently surfaced on Facebook. I take these things very seriously.
Nancy Cordes, there are already charges there, hate crime charges in Chicago. But, oh, how we hate to see this kind of thing at all. And when it's gone viral on Facebook, I mean, it's a horrible thing to watch. But these days, everything, it seems, ends up captured, shared all over the place. The fact that this is coming in the same week as we've got a jury sitting in in the Charleston case of Dylan Roof, you know, where, of course, there were murders, multiple mass murders there. Here we got a beating in Chicago. How does the country digest this, Nancy? This is just – and apparently we're reading reports that the teenagers involved in this are unrepentant about it. Their life is going to get harder in a hurry here. How do we take this on board, and how does it feed into the sort of racial moment that's been bubbling along now for quite a while?
Well, I think it's incredibly disturbing, and I'd say a couple things. First of all, you know, there was a very a serious debate over the course of this election about criminal justice reform, and that is something that a number of senators are going to be talking to Jeff Sessions, who is the attorney general nominee for President-elect Trump, and many Democratic senators in particular are pushing for not just criminal justice reform, but help for police, overburdened police in cities like Chicago, where the homicide rate has spiked. And that is something I know that concerns the president-elect as well, and he's talked about the homicide rate there. Beyond
that, if that means stop and frisk, you could see a whole new round of tensions emerging in Chicago and elsewhere.
There's no consensus about what the best way is to tackle this problem. And beyond that, interestingly, in the Clapper hearing, to go back to mm-hmm. what we started out talking about, you know, there was a lot of discussion about how we're kind of in the Wild West of social media right now, because there are so few rules governing our behavior when it comes to social media. And you see something so incredibly disturbing, like those four people who live streamed this attack. And it's not just violence. It's the way that we talk on social media. It's the way that we communicate. It's how hooked young people get. You know, there's a whole host of issues surrounding our use of what is, you know, when you look at the big picture, a very young technology and way of life, and we haven't really formed norms yet around how we use it and how we treat others when we're using it.
Well, but there's, I mean, sure, it's hard to watch it, but it's the beating itself, which is, I guess, the ultimate problem here. Now the country is seeing it and thinking about how to take it on board. Let me go to Tim in Kennebunk, Maine. Tim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. My concern is that by giving all this media attention, not just radio but television, that, you know, we're going to create kids in this era who are all want to be stars. They'll be copycats. I wouldn't have seen this had it not been on the morning news on television, because I don't do social media. But I think these kids all, it's dangerous to give too much attention to these horrific incidents.
Yeah, I hear you, Tim. But Tom Bullock, I mean, it's already out there. It's on Facebook
exactly
Live. It's streaming all over the place. TV is not the only portal to the world anymore at all.
No, this is like cover a live broadcast of torture. In essence, is what the police have, how they've described it. And from the brief snippets I've seen of the video, that's accurate. And what worries me, at this time when America seems so divided on so many different levels, race, politics, like socioeconomic levels, whatever it is, what worries me is with social media, you can't control that. It doesn't have the same rules as broadcast, to get to Tim's point.
There's no editor who can say, nix that.
Exactly. But you worry about this having a long-term effect of making us fear the other so much more than potentially we already do. I mean, this concept of the other, whether it's white or black or different politics, whatever, it's a social fabric issue. It's a little tear that can get a lot bigger if people don't actively try to stop it.
Siobhan, right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. Siobhan, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. And I was actually just the caller before me said a lot about what I was going to say. And so I really just wanted to, I know you guys are about to talk about Megyn Kelly with Fox News, and I think this kind of plays into the same idea of normalizing some really provocative, and if you want to talk about racial tension, some of the things that she talked about on Fox News, and I'm just worried about her now.
Santa Claus is white and all the rest. Okay, but that's kind of, I mean, I hear you. I hear the relationship, but then here we are with a different order, an actual beating, almost torture, Siobhan. How do you look at it? What should we do? How should we think about it?
I think Facebook and social media is now just elevating things that have already been happening. I don't think it's normalizing it. It's more of just exposing what's already been happening. And I think the Facebook video out of Chicago is one example, but then all of the numerous videos about not only criminal behavior with amongst African Americans and in schools and the young lady who got slammed down to the ground. I think Facebook and social media is now just exposing things that have been happening in this country for years.
And there were, the Dylann Roof trial in Charleston, where does that stand now? We're waiting for a sentencing to happen there,
the
right?
The sentencing phase is actually underway right now, Tom. And the jury found him guilty on 33 charges, of course, going back to the nine people he killed in the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston.
Yeah.
So this phase of the trial, for people who aren't aware, this is when the jury decides whether or not he gets life in prison
yeah.
or the death penalty. And so where we're at now is we're hearing from the victims' families, survivors, from potentially Dylann Roof himself, because he has eschewed his lawyers in this phase of the trial
yes.
and wants to represent himself. And so far, what we have seen is a Dylann Roof who he is not repentant. He does not regret it. He acknowledges what he did. He has not at any point yet asked the jury to spare his life. It's a strange and painful thing to watch. But right now, it's just, you know, Dylann Roof standing there not really doing a whole lot except listening along with the jury to, you know, the victims.
All the horrors of that night. He said at the outset he wanted to start a race war.
That's correct.
And the first response was, you didn't and you won't. Now here we are at the same time we're thinking about sentencing, life or death. And we've got this video out of Chicago. And you wonder, Tom, I mean, you're reporting here out of Charlotte, like, wait a minute.
Yeah, and right here, too, in Charlotte, not too long ago, we had the Keith Scott shooting riots.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back again to that social fabric concept I was talking about. It's a difficult time for America. And our caller was right. You know, social media does show things that have been happening for a long time. But now everybody's walking around with a camera in their pocket so they can catch things. However, there are certain things that do not happen all the time. And when they're broadcast on social media, I share Tim's concern, or the prior caller's concern, that this could lead to potential copycats.
Jack Beatty, you've got a new president coming in who's going to have all this in his lap. I mean, his New Year's tweet, you know, you think of presidents as kind of calming the waters, but that tweet was, "Happy New Year to all, including to my many enemies," Donald Trump wrote, "and those who have fought me and lost so badly they just don't know what to do, love." This hardly sounds like a president who has got the kind of healing waters in his pocket, Jack.
No, he just has a hurt that 60 million people didn't vote for him, 60 million plus. Mara Liasson, I think her quick quip was best, Donald Trump is a poor winner. And this does show really one of the most disturbing aspects of his personality, this wounded, brooding narcissism, this sense of, you know, if anyone gives me even a slight, I remember it and I get back. That is not the profile of a successful president. Maybe he'll surprise us all. Maybe he'll surprise probability. But that was a disturbing tweet.
There's a lot coming here, and the president will have his chance in office. Nancy Cordes, can you begin to see the inauguration day stuff going up in Washington? Is preparation obvious?
Absolutely. But to Jack's point, I think the tweet of the day actually has to go to Arnold Schwarzenegger, who responded to Donald Trump and his criticism of Schwarzenegger's ratings on The Apprentice by saying, there's nothing more important than the people's work. Mr. Trump, and I wish you the best of luck, and I hope you'll work for all of the American people as aggressively as you worked for your ratings.
Schooled by Arnold Schwarzenegger himself there, and we will soon see, with Donald Trump approaching inauguration today very rapidly, Nancy Cordes there in Washington, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Tom Bullock, political and investigative reporter for WFAE Public Radio in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thanks as always for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.